You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Eileen Wuornos, often labeled America's first female serial killer, was executed by lethal injection in Florida in 2002. Her life was one of endless trauma and abuse, beginning as a child and extending into her adult life as a prostitute. The men she killed were reportedly Johns. She insisted all these murders were done in self-defense. Phyllis Chesler recently published a book about Eileen's life, crimes, and trial. Chesler was heavily involved in Eileen's case back in the 90s, viewing her then as a feminist folk hero of sorts, only responding to threats against her life. Phyllis wanted the world to understand the trauma endured by women in prostitution. She saw a potential defense of Eileen in a version of battered women's syndrome or battered wife syndrome, something traditionally used to defend women who kill their abusive husbands after years of torture, claiming self-defense. In November, Phyllis published Requiem for a Female Serial Killer, a psychological crime thriller. Phyllis is a retired professor of psychology and women's studies and the author of numerous books, including Women in Madness and A Politically Incorrect Feminist. I spoke with her in October 2020 from her home in New York City. First of all, thanks so much for talking with me about your book. I appreciate it.
I appreciate your site, and I love your politics. So, easy peasy.
When and why did you first become interested in Eileen Wuornos' story?
When I first heard the announcement that they're looking for two women who have killed potentially seven men along I-75, the highway in Florida, as I write in the book, I thought, well, this is an Orson Welles put-on. The Martians have landed. This can't be real because Earth women don't go around killing a bunch of men who are strangers to them. It's never happened. So I was immediately captivated. And I thought, well, could this be feminists in Florida? I knew of some gun collectives that had gun practice and target practice. Could they have done this? And then I thought, no, it's probably swamp creatures from hell who've been through a sordid life and who that's it. They'd had enough, and indeed Wuornos finally said just that, I'd had enough. So, and that means enough of the rapes. But I didn't know that yet. What interested me, once she was captured, was the importance of expanding the battered woman syndrome, which is not a psychiatric cop-out, to cover prostitutes and prostituted women, because they're battered and raped all the time. It's the nature of, not their work, but the war in which they're in. And I thought, wouldn't it be something to get a team together of experts? And I had them ready to testify to a jury about prostitution is the most extreme form of violence against woman, all womankind, and that it's very plausible that a prostitute could have killed in self-defense. Absolutely plausible. And there were a number of cases in the 1970s in which women of color mainly argued self-defense, rape self-defense in two cases, and potential rape self-defense in a third case. And they eventually were free. So I thought, wouldn't that be something? So I was totally engaged, and probably in a sense to have such feminist fervor and passion and purpose is a little crazy. I didn't know what I would be dealing with, really.
When did you first reach out to her, to Eileen?
Well, I first reached out to her public defenders, who didn't return any of my calls, and because she was in jail, I couldn't just call her.
So what year was this?
So I flew down to Florida, and I tried to meet with the public defenders.
Wait, sorry to interrupt. What year was this?
This is 1991.
Okay. Sorry,
she committed the murders. The first one, total case of self-defense, and the guy she was forced to kill was a really bad dude. He was into pornography. He was into hookers. He had done 4 years in jail for attempted rape, which is strange because men don't get sentenced for this. But he was a bad guy. But that was information that the public defenders did not want to allow as testimony because the dead man is not on trial, although he should have been. So I'm in a motel, and I realize that I'm going to have to go and meet this woman who owns a horse farm, heavily mortgaged horse farm, who began writing to Lee, Eileen Lee Carol Warnos, who began writing to her and who ultimately adopted her and heart-friended her. And this is a born-again Christian who's, I have to say, a colorful character, to say the very least. And she was on the phone with Warnos all the time. And the media was prowling, 50, 100 phone calls a day. So I had to meet her and gain her confidence. And that was not easy. And I succeeded. And so I'm back at my motel. And the phone rings, and it's Lee calling me collect. And as I said in the first or in the introduction to Requiem for a Female Serial Killer, I knew I'd have only a few seconds of her attention. So I said, well, why not? I'll just risk it all. And I said, look, I represent a feminist government from the future, and we're aware that you've been captured, and we'd like to help. And she said, without missing a beat, she said, far fucking out, man. You're the women's lib. Tell the women out there that the men hate our guts, that we're innocent. I had to defend myself. I figured, oh, this is going to be some ride. So from that moment on, I had to placate the new best friend, pimp, mother, whoever she was, a woman named Arlene Praley. And soon enough, Lee tells her public defenders, you got to talk to Chesla. She's got the testifying witnesses, quote unquote, I want them. In which case, Trish Jenkins, her lead public defender, calls me and says, get yourself over to my office right now. What did you say to my client to make her sound like a feminist? Well, she was a quick study. She sounded like anything she thought you wanted to hear. And in my case, it would have been feminist talk. If she was with a John, or in her own life, such as it was, she would sound more like a Marine or like a jock of some kind, using language that I would never use. But to get inside her head in the book, I'm using it all the time. So that's how it began.
What was she like? Like, did you like her? Was she, you know?
We had many phone calls, and we had a correspondence, and I have some of the letters in a chapter in this book. I didn't expect to like her. This was a political gambit. And I tried to explain this to her, but she didn't get it because, really, she's the lady and I'm the tramp, the entire feminist group with me. We want to overthrow the patriarchy. We're not looking for a little piece of the pie for ourselves. She was. She was a petit bourgeois capitalist. So trying to explain to her what our goals were or why we were even there by her side didn't make sense to her because nobody does something for nothing. Everything is about money. So who are we kidding? Trying to con her, are we? So this was not an easy relationship. Now, what was she like? Before she went completely insane on death row and should never have been executed because she was insane by then, as so many are, she had three different voices. One was like a Marine giving orders, barking orders, very angry, very, very aggressive. One was kind of Joplin Husky-like, soft, sweet, and girlish. And one was a born-again Christian. Everyone on death row in Florida becomes a born-again Christian. They find God there in this narrow, terrible place. And there she channeled the Bible. You know, she had found God on death row. So I'm not about to say she's a multiple personality. I'll say she had different voices. She was very demanding. She was very quick. She drew beautifully. She said she taught herself her own handwriting. She said she read many books, although her writing is illiterate. It's lots and lots of not misspellings, and it's handwritten, so it's not that you made a typo on a typewriter. And lots of bad grammar, so I don't know how much she could teach herself. As I looked into her life, it's one of the worst cases of extreme child abuse that I've ever run into, and I've run into a lot. She's of Finnish origin and comes from Michigan, from Troy, Michigan. Her father, her biological father, hung himself in jail. He was a convicted pedophile. She never met him. She never met her biological mother either, because her biological maternal grandparents ran that mother, whose name was Diane, out of town. And Diane never looked back, never went back, was afraid to return. In fact, one of the compliments, the biggest compliments of my life as a researcher, was when I tracked her mother down and got her on the phone. And she was living in Texas at the time. And after about 15 minutes of conversation, she goes, "Oh, talking to you is so easy. It's like you're a relative. You know everyone in the family." And I thought, oh, that is a star on my forehead indeed. But I called her not just to get information, which I got, but to urge her to visit Lee in jail. And her response was, "No, no, I can't do that. I'm afraid of her. She has a terrible temper. I'm afraid of her." So there was that too. She had a very bad hairline trigger temper and didn't hold back and went up against the guys head to head, toe to toe, knee to knee. Nobody, no, she didn't care if they, she didn't care if her Johns, if they didn't rob her and if they weren't part of a gang rape. And if they didn't steal her money, they were her friends. You know, she needed to eat. They had the money. It wasn't fair, but that was the deal. So she got money, and they got to rape her, and everybody was happy. I hadn't thought this through, the nature of, and she didn't complain about any of this. But when she, after she committed that first murder in self-defense, which she claimed 16 times in her confession, and the jury never got to hear a single claim of self-defense in the first murder, but in fact knew all about the subsequent six murders. She was hard to deal with, hard to defend. Many women, feminist women, before she developed a cult following and earnest supporters, feminist radical abolitionist supporters, I would have women say, look, she's not a sympathetic figure. Why are you bothering with her? Or women would say to me, she's not a role model for feminism. You're going to, like, degrade our brand. And I didn't have the words right away to say, but look, she's been through hell and back thousands of times. I don't know how, you know, she's like a torture victim. How could she be nice? How could she be sympathetic? And, yeah, it's very hard for women who are judged so harshly and preemptively and prematurely, it's hard for women to then stand by the side of a really badass woman, right, with a foul mouth and a temper, who's a whore.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good test for feminism, though, right? I mean, feminism can't just stand with the women they like.
I would say I agree with you, of course. But you can't imagine how, yes, you can, how many women are afraid, since their hold is so tenuous on whatever status they may have, to risk standing with the truly wretched of the earth. So I was a fool, though, because I was so fixed. I was deluded, thinking we could actually rescue her. Yes, it's possible. And I didn't understand that this is not possible, that there are too many women who... And I had experience working with battered women, and I had to stop because I didn't have the patience of a saint, literally, to keep accepting them back after they returned time after time to the batterer and only finally left when they were convinced he was about to kill them. There are other feminists who can do that. Imagine working with a woman who's prostituted and who's been battered by thousands of men, raped by thousands, hundreds of thousands of men. How are you going to save her? And there are brilliant feminists now, brave and brilliant, who have addressed this problem and who've attempted to set up shelters for prostitutes who want to come in out of the cold. And that's not easy.
Mm. So, the grandparents ran her biological mother out of town. Do we know why that was?
Well, the grandparents were drunks, and the grandfather was a sadistic bully who used to beat her badly, and who said things like, I ought to hang you, you worthless piece of shit. And this is to a child, to herself and her brother. And she did not know that her grandparents were not really her biological parents. They lied to her. So the adoption triangle begins to play its role here. And that's true of many serial killers, by the way. So the point I was going to make is I didn't even focus on the fact that she might really be a serial killer, because I was very focused on the feminist mission. It took me years to grasp the nature of how unique a serial killer she really was, but she was, is a serial killer. And the grandparents, I mean, the grandmother drank, the grandfather drank. She was probably born with organic brain syndrome, had visual and hearing impairments, never corrected. She had a learning disorder of some kind, certainly never corrected. She stopped, so in a sense, she may have been born with bad genes, but, you know, you could potentially, you think, overcome some of that, but not if you're tossed out as a child to literally live in an abandoned car in the snow. Not if you, unlike male serial killers, have been raped as a child repeatedly. And in fact, in her case, after having what she calls lots of willing sex, she was raped and impregnated when she was 13 and gave away the child, a boy, to adoption. So she was really adopted by her biological grandparents. She, in turn, gave away a child for adoption, at which point she told her aunt, who she thought was her sister, a woman named Lori, that men really hate us. And she then lit out on her own. She may have done some time in a juvenile facility. She didn't like that. She didn't want to stay there. She smoked pot, but became very proud of no dope in her life, just lots and lots of beer. And she then sold sex for food, sex for beer, sex to survive in her fashion. And she was like a child. I didn't realize the extent to which that was true either, because if she had enough money for food for today and tomorrow and money for a motel room for today and tomorrow, that was fine. That was great. So when her brother died and left her $10,000 in his life insurance, she blew it in 3 months. She was not the kind of person who'd say, oh, I have a nest egg, I'm going to pay for an education, or I'm going to buy a little home. No. She was on the road, and she blew it on food, on beer, on music, and on a car, which was repossessed within 3 months. So she didn't plan ahead. She didn't have the cognitive capacity to plan ahead. So in many ways, she was, I'm not sure why, because she also was a canny and cunning survivor. She was like a child. No long future sense. So why did her grandparents trick her and then abuse her? God knows. But you know what? It's not even just on them. Where was the rest of the town? Where was the state of Michigan? These throwaway girls like refuse? Not their problem?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's odd. I'm not familiar with the state and how things work there, but it's odd there were no services or service workers that reached out to her.
Well, maybe she snarled them away. Maybe it was too much trouble. Maybe they didn't have the mindset to reach out to an angry, hot-tempered, obstinate, stubborn, aggressive 14 or 15-year-old. Mm-hmm. Who didn't clean up after herself was one accusation. That her biological uncle, brother, came to her trial to testify against her, to redeem the reputation of their father. So she comes from the kind of family where you're lucky if they don't kill you. Mm-hmm. You don't turn to them for help. And I think this is not just her. I think this is very representative of the kinds of lives, childhoods, homes that prostitutes come from, where they've been incested and beaten and neglected, and finally, when they run away, then they're homeless, and they have no money, and they have no job skills, and they're not that well educated, and guess into whose arms they're driven? Pimps. And once that happens, there's no turning back. There's no chance of escape. There is now a little bit chance, courtesy of feminist abolitionists, but no chance. I mean, you get gang raped, you get seasoned, you get beaten, you get death threatened. You don't have any money. The money all goes to the man, and you can't get out. You can't save anything. I mean, do you ever notice how the myth that Hollywood gives us, the happy hooker, Julia Roberts, Pretty Woman, this is not true. They're on the streets. Now, you're in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So you know more than I know about Native American women who are not just forced into prostitution, homeless and forced into for that reason, but who were killed, and they're killed by real serial killers who are men. It's men who are the serial killers, and they mainly kill prostitutes, many of whom are women of color and very young, and who, of course, are addicted to some drug, because how can you survive a war without it, since you don't have a gun? Warnos got a gun. That's another thing that sets her apart. So the girls from highly dysfunctional families, and there are, alas, are too many, with parents in jail, with parents who have step-parents who beat and hate and starve and rape the child. And there are some boys in this category, but it's mainly girls and women. And then the pimps own them. And the pimps, that's the government that wants to legalize or decriminalize. That's the landlords. That's the police. That's anyone who's on the take and on the make, who can get a piece of a business globally that's possibly far bigger than guns and drugs. And that business is female sexual slavery.
How old was Eileen, or Lee, when she killed Richard Mallory?
Let me see if I could look it up. It was 1989. She was born in 56. She was in her mid-30s. She was born in on February 29th, which means her birthday didn't come around all the time. And she gave birth to a son in 1971. And she was arrested many times, and she attempted suicide 6 times, but couldn't even succeed at that. Mm-hmm. And she did time in prison, and there were outstanding warrants for her arrest. And as I relate it, I try to relate it from her point of view, that each of these arrests really were not her fault. She just had nobody helping her, and a lot of bad luck, and a lot of misunderstandings. And I totally get it from her point of view. So she killed Richard Mallory either the night of November 30th or the night of December 1st in 1989. So how old was she? No.
I mean, she was a little over 30, 32 or something like that.
Yes, something 30, like yeah. that. Yes.
Anyway, I mean, and at that point, this was the first man she had murdered?
That we know of, mm-hmm. that she's been accused of, yes.
Mm-hmm. And how many men did she kill in total?
7. And I think I really, even though she recanted her own tale, which she told me, told her best friend from childhood, Dawn Botkins, who published some of their correspondence, and told many of the media who interviewed her. I really believe she killed him in self-defense. I don't have any doubt about it. I don't know why she later on needed to recant it, but so she did. And I disagreed with her based on everything that she told me and everything that I studied and all the interviews that I did. So I think something happened after that, because think of it from her point of view. She already is a prostitute. That's illegal. She's a criminal by definition. Not the Johns. They're fine. The women are the ones that get arrested, that get records, that get fined. So, and there was an outstanding warrant for her on another matter. So she couldn't go to the police and say, hey, listen, this guy was trying to kill me. They would have just said, you've killed him, you're guilty. So she had to live with what had happened, and she didn't plan it. It's not like it was a plan. It's not like she was a cunning predator with a big plan. This happened, and she saved her own life. And she had a gun because some guy in the military or some police officer, John, said, listen, you really need a gun. I mean, men understood what it is to be in a war, and you got to be armed. Women don't have that knowledge, so, or certainly in her life. And she hid out for a while, and she pawned whatever stuff she got, and she ditched the car, but she didn't do any of these things in a way that would cover her tracks. It was very non-strategic. And then she had to eat, right? So she had to go on the road again. Imagine her mindset. So I think several things were at work, and this is just my own guessing. She put into practice her own personalized affirmative action program. If a guy, for example, who said he was a cop and he therefore wanted it for no money or he would arrest her, and there were two or three like that, and they were Johns because they were naked. They were found naked, even though their relatives have said innocent, great men, family men, but they were naked. What were they doing naked with a woman? Mm-hmm. One wonders. So she, if somebody got rough with her, if somebody pushed her around, if somebody wanted something that she didn't damn well want to do, she killed them. Kill them. And this is the first time in one of the chapters, it's the first time in 10,000 years that you have a woman preying on men, killing them all over the place, men whom they don't know. Prostitutes killing Johns, right? That's like the very bottom of society suddenly triumphing. That's another thing that dazzled many feminists and many lesbian feminists. Just the image, even though she's not a political operative, she's not a feminist operative, to be able to do that is amazing. Think of how many girls and women only had fantasies about killing their father who kept raping them, but never did, never could. Or killing men who really betrayed them and abused them and wrecked them and stole everything from them, including their children, but never did.
Mm-hmm.
She did. Hot damn. This is different.
Do you think that something changed for her? So when she killed Richard Mallory, you know, when he brutalized her, you know, she was probably rightly afraid that he would kill her. And then, so let's say she killed him and then she goes on to kill six other men. Do you think that, I mean, first of all, do you think that all of those murders that happened afterwards were in self-defense?
No, no, I don't. That's where I'm guessing. I mean, if you read in this book about how she defined rape and what rape meant to her and what her prostitute's life was like, it's just heart-rending. It's, like, horrifying. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view alone, she's entitled to jump out of her mind. Mm-hmm. At any point, at any moment, for any reason. But that's not what she did, although she was always drunk. She was always drunk. So, I mean, given that what passes for neutral is prurient disgust for the women whom men annihilate, that's the default. That's neutrality in our culture. So, in a sense, one would ask, why aren't more prostitutes able to do this? And, of course, the answer is they're too beaten down, and they can't. So, she was very rigid cognitively. I mean, it's kind of funny, the fights that she had with bus drivers over where exactly they had to stop, where exactly they had to let her off. She fought with everyone. She made herself quite unpleasant, apparently. But what was, I think, after this first murder in self-defense, she had nothing to lose. So if she didn't like the deal, if a guy got rough with her or wanted something she didn't want to give him, not even for money, or in one or two instances, which I write about in Requiem, there were men who didn't want her services. Well, hey, man, isn't that like stealing from me? They have it. They have the credit cards. They have the houses. They have the cars. They have the families. I have nothing. It's my money that they got, right? So at some unconscious level, in one or two instances, she just killed them because she wanted the money in their car that was must have been there somewhere in their wallets, and they didn't want to. They didn't want to have sex with her. Didn't want to give her the money that she needed. So
I wonder why you think that there are so few female serial killers. You know, serial killers
No, but she's totally unique, and it took me years to focus on that as I was lost in my feminist romance of rescue and justice and so on. There are women who are serial killers, many, but they kill husbands and they do it for money. And they kill husband after husband or boyfriend after boyfriend. There are women serial killers who kill their patients, ideally after the patients have been forced to turn over their insurance policies. There are women who prostitute girls, and I give some examples, they're awful, and murder them if they try to run away, or torture them and murder them if they try to run away, to set an example that, you know, none of the others should. These are all serial killers, in my opinion. And the women are dubbed black widows. There are women who are abused as badly as Warnos was, but they didn't become serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
That's another whole story. There are men who are the majority, who are 90% of the serial killers, who prey, as I may have mentioned, on prostitutes and on women who they think are prostitutes, whether they are or not, and they torture them and they murder them. And there were plenty of serial killers operating all over the state of Florida, and the police couldn't find them. And they kept finding the corpses of girls and women, and I write about some of this, but that's the default. That's the given. Now, how is Warnos totally different and unique? She punched up. She took on guys who were towering over her, who weighed more than she did. Maybe they were older, that's true. Some were not that much older, maybe a decade. So what she did hasn't been done. There are prostitutes who may have killed one John and then got out and perhaps never spoke about it, never told anybody. It's dangerous. But she kept doing it to men who were strangers, white men in Florida. It's unheard of. Unheard of. And she didn't operate the way male serial killers do, who, according to Jane Caputi, one of the many, many brilliant feminist abolitionist writers, Melissa Farley, too, there's an honor roll of women feminists who've been working in this area. This male serial killers will torture and murder a woman and then pose her in some obscene gynecological pose, you know, sort of satanic misogyny triumphing over female reproductive and sexual capacity. She covered these corpses with blankets. She put them a little further back in the woods, which is where she was raped and impregnated, by the way, and yeah, maybe it's a return to the original trauma in some attempt to rewrite that. But she covered their bodies, their corpses. This is different. This is not what men who are serial killers do. So, What do you think?
Why do you think it is that men, I mean, first of all, what would you argue is, in general, the difference in terms of motivations for male serial killers versus female serial killers?
Female serial killers do it for money, because we don't have the money. The men have the money.
Mm-hmm.
And so historically, the women who've killed husbands or boyfriends or patients are motivated, you could say, by greed, but I would say just motivated by the need for money. She didn't do it for the money. Or one could say that childlike, she thought a couple hundred dollars was money. And that changed, by the way, once she was captured and on death row. That changed big time. She became obsessed with the money that others might be making, quote, off of what she did. And she was obsessed with getting a percentage, a piece of the take. And I now understand that this is true for male serial killers as well. Obsessed with notoriety and fame, her own. She said, I made history. I'm in the history books. And she's right. Yes, and not because she was a corpse in a gynecological pose, obscene, but because she was a killer. Turned the tables. And she was very proud of that and would never really discuss the details of any of the murders. Would not, did not. So I had to imagine it based on my understanding of her.
So Eileen killed men who either, you know, raped and tortured and abused her, or, you know, possibly raped and tortured and abused other women. You know, men who often fought prostitutes, who often are sadistic people.
Yeah.
But how was this treated by the court and the media at the time? You know, how was she represented and portrayed?
Oh, God. Well, you know, I tried to raise the money to get a private lawyer, for a political trial. And then I became very sick with Lyme's disease and chronic fatigue, and no one took my place. So the public defender was very savvy, but was used to defending the rapists and the male serial killers. This was different. This was new. And from her point of view, how could a win in any way help her reputation and her work? I'm not saying she threw the case, by the way. I'm just saying that think of the variables that if she got off the dike a whore killer, I don't know whether the good old boys in the club there of public defenders would be that happy with her. The trial was not just. The jury... Trish did ask for a change of venue, and that's something that Ted Bundy got, but she did not. So that means the jurors had been reading, instead of going to Miami, where maybe people weren't up on the details, the local papers had something about her every single day, and everybody had drawn their conclusions. So a change of venue might have been good. The prosecutor... Ironically, disgustingly, the prosecutor was very anti-prostitution. He viewed prostitutes in his own articles that he published as causing disease in men, like giving men sexually transmitted diseases and HIV when it's precisely the other way around. And he had a judge. The first judge had been a woman that got rid of her. I forget on what grounds. And now this new judge is the very judge who the prosecutor had swear him in as a prosecutor. So they were buddies, or certainly close colleagues. And John Tanna, the prosecutor, was Ted Bundy's spiritual advisor, who shared his belief that pornography made him do it. I don't believe that for one minute in Bundy's case. But that was Tanna's interest, to expose the evil of pornography. Very. So the judge did not allow. There was a woman named Jackie Davis who had been a girlfriend of Richard Mallory, the first man she killed in self-defense. She wanted to testify about what a bad guy he was, but she was not allowed to do so. And absolutely no one took the stand on Eileen's behalf. No one. She did. And I was impressed. I watched it from afar. I was impressed with how she handled everything. She was moving. She was credible. I was surprised. But they found her guilty in under 2 hours, and they gave her the death sentence in under 2 hours. Whereas with Bundy, who had killed maybe 30 to 100 girls and women, they deliberated much longer. So one of the grounds for the appeal to the Florida Supreme Court in the first case was they didn't use any of my expert witnesses, which she had wanted. Of course, it didn't go anywhere. The Florida Supreme Court upheld the death sentence, and she pled out all the other charges, the other trials, the other murders. And she then went on to make deals with the scum of the earth. There was a lawyer who this Arlene Praley sort of made a deal with, and they were charging the media for their interviews with her. And what she got was a percentage of the take into her commissary. And you know what she did with the money? She would buy gifts for other of the girls, as she put it, who didn't have anybody. And it was, you know, food, candy, whatever you get in a prison commissary. So she kept asking me for stamps, and I kept sending them. And she was so psychologically disfigured that each new batch of supporters, admirers, fans, feminist firebrands who wrote to her and wanted to help her, she ultimately had fallings out with, and would tell each new bunch that the previous bunch just wanted to get famous off her and wanted to get money off her. Oh, so sad, so sad. So then over time, I would get letters from groups of feminists, lesbian feminists as well, who said they're sorry they didn't consult me earlier. They heard from her that I was out just for the money and the fame. And they believed her, and then, of course, she turned on them, and they no longer believed her. So I have a good deal of the correspondence from them. And then I went and I interviewed her lover, who she was living with, who betrayed her on the stand. I drove up to Pennsylvania, where she was living. I never met such a tough woman before. I can only assume that Lee must have been tougher. I don't know. Because really tough. And but with an extended family and resources that Lee did not have. Lee only had Tyria. And Tyria told me that she began to get afraid of Lee, and didn't want to stay anymore. So when the police found her and set her up to trap Lee into confessing, which is what happened, Lee confessed because she loved her. And Tyria was saying, they're coming after me, I can't handle it, they're coming after my family, I didn't do anything. And Lee said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. So she, as I said in Requiem for a Female Serial Killer, I said she really was a fool for love. At the end of the day, she loved this, she was a closed-mouthed, hefty butch. And Lee by the way, the Charlize Theron impersonation of Lee, it was, you know, very good, but it wasn't true, because Tyria was no Christina Ricci figure. She was tough, 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 and not a clinging vine. And Lee was very aggressive physically. According to a couple of the people who rented her rooms and sold her food, she would go around flexing her muscles, and when men would pull up to the gas station, she'd snarl at them if they were young, because she didn't like young men. They were too brutal and too dangerous for her. And she was physically powerful, and she would swish her hair around, not the way Valley Girls did, but the way lions do with their manes. She was different.
Was this the first relationship she'd had with a woman?
Well, apparently, there was a woman who she went into a pressure cleaning business with, who then ran out on her, according to Lee, and who also took the equipment. And then there was Tyria. Yes. So that was, and Lee did not hate men. You know, she liked them. They were fresh. She considered, this is another thing that made me begin to think about how childlike in a way she is. She thought that Johns were like her friends, and boyfriends, didn't see what the big deal was. And she was comfortable with men passing through her, and certainly had her heart broken early on by any number of men. She was bisexual or asexual, and she never understood why the men mistreated her, if indeed that's the case, because I bet it was a two-way street.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think that a lot of people, men in particular, think of prostitutes as, like, hypersexual women, when in reality, most prostitutes, you know, women that I've talked to who've been in prostitution don't have any sex lives to speak of and have totally kind of shut down their sexuality, in fact, in their personal lives.
It's tragic. They've been castrated, and they have to dissociate so that they're not there and it's not them that these things are happening to. And they have to pretend also that it's great and groovy and they're coming and it's fabulous all the time. So, no, they don't usually have what we would call sex lives. And no, they're not, it's the men who are filled with lust and who then scapegoat women for their own sinful lust, for their brutality. It's the women who then are the scapegoats for it. It's so obvious. And it's also, sadly, as I'm reading more and more studies and first-person memoirs by women who've been in that life, I think, well, I don't get feminists romanticizing or glorifying prostitution. It's like glorifying marriage. I mean, these are two bad choices that patriarchy gives. On the other hand, and I don't despise either women who make either of these forced choices, the problem is that in thinking, well, how do we then abolish prostitution? How do we do that? Well, when we abolish misogyny and poverty and racism and war and genocide, then we may have a chance at abolishing prostitution, but not sooner. And that's a very sad thing I've just said. And further, I fear, as I'm sure you do, that we're moving into an era not just of transgender rights preempting women's rights, oh, beyond that, but we're moving into an era of legalized surrogacy and decriminalization or legalization of, quote, sex work, with the full support of the gay community and large parts of the feminist communities. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. But here we are.
Mm-hmm. So Eileen was sentenced to death, of course, which I think is, you know, unfair, reprehensible, etc.
Yes.
I mean, I don't support the death penalty, period, but definitely not for abused women. Do you think she should have been convicted at all?
Well, it's a good question. Probably, well, you know, if we were writing a novel, no, she should have been allowed to go free. She's never been free in her life. I don't know if she could have handled freedom of any kind. I try to suggest that she consider an insanity plea, and she wouldn't hear of it. And frankly, I said, well, but I think you'd make it. I don't think you'd have a big problem. No, she wanted nothing to do with that idea. She didn't want anyone prying inside her head. She's fine. Well, would they ever have let her out of a mental asylum? No. Florida is a very funny state. They have apparently let out people, including women, you know, who've committed many murders. Okay. Don't understand it. So if she had gone to Chattahoochee, you know, a state mental asylum, and if they had pumped her full of terrible drugs, would that be better than all the years she spent on death row getting really insane, but really insane? She believes that they were poisoning her food and that there were rays of some kind coming through the ceiling into her head. I mean, insane. And it is not legal to execute an insane person, but I think Jeb Bush wanted to be reelected governor, and so he was, and he signed her execution. So no, I don't think, I mean, if we understand that what Johns do to prostitutes is itself a crime that wrecks a girl and a woman, wrecks, kills, destroys, then we might look at the attempts, like 7 out of 250,000 Johns, for example. You know, she was restrained, you might say, if we were writing not a dystopian novel, but toward the end of this book. Do you know Helen Zahavi's novel, Dirty Weekend? Oh, you must read it. It's hilarious. It's about an ex-prostitute who's washed up and beaten down. Her name is Bella, and she's living in Brighton. And some creep starts calling her on her unlisted number. She's living in a dark basement with barely enough food, and he's saying all these things that he's going to do to her. Without going into a lot of detail, so she finally confronts him and kills him. She kills him. And Zahavi, she's graphic and gruesome and funny. She's way over the top. And now her character goes on to kill 6 other men, all of whom were out of line, all of whom tried to hurt her badly, all of whom assumed they could do what they wanted to her and get away with it. So Zahavi then, and you know, we're not used to having women hold their own or take revenge. Oh, not at all. So Zahavi closes her novel with a warning. She says, if you see a woman walking and you want her, think on. Don't touch her. Don't place your palm across her mouth and drag her to the ground. For unwittingly, you might have laid your heavy hand on Bella. And she's woken up this morning with the knowledge that she's finally had enough. And in an interview with Court TV, Lee said, quote, it took me 17 years to finally kill somebody. But I got stone cold and said, you know, enough is enough. End of quote.
I think that people might argue that, you know, well, people do argue that Everyone needs to be accountable for their behavior or their crimes, you know, even if things are more complicated. You know, it's not untrue that abused men will often abuse others. And of course, it doesn't make it okay. I wonder, yeah, would you say that Eileen should have been, despite her, you know, lifetime of really horrific abuse that was inflicted on her, should she have been accountable in some way? Should she have been charged? I mean, would you see things differently if she were a man?
Well, the thing is that men don't get raped and impregnated and forced into giving children up for adoption. And yes, men do get raped, but by other men. And some of them, you know, just slink away and lead lesser lives, and some become abusers themselves. But the deck is so stacked against women, so stacked, that anyone who fights back, already you think, give her a parade. I mean, when a battered woman finally kills, in self-defense, but he's sleeping, right, the Francine Hughes story, and there's no other way for her to do it, instead of being sentenced to a very long time in prison, I say give her a parade. She saved her own life. Nobody else did. Not a single member of society or her family or his family wanted to save her life. So do I think that women have agency? Not when they're prostitutes, excuse me, no. If you read enough, these are forced, coerced, non-choices. And it's a ticket to hell with no exit. There's no exit allowed. So I don't think prostitution is a choice, and I don't think it's a line of work, although I understand that there are some feminists who do. And that's another whole discussion we can have, maybe another time. We can't compare an apple and an orange. It's not so easy to compare men who are violent and who commit crimes with women who are violent and commit crimes, because the men get away with a whole lot for a long time. Some get away with all of it forever. Women are never allowed to get away with anything. So do I think that Warner should have been walking around leading the life fantastic among us? No. By then, she was ruined and would have had to have been, I was about to say hospitalized, but I know too much about hospitals. She needed a shelter. She needed to be sheltered. I don't know whether she could have been rehabilitated. Doubt it, but you know, maybe. She should have been in a place where she could not harm anyone else and where she would not be forced to be a prostitute. Mm-hmm. Trying to imagine, that's a good question, where could she have been placed? Where could she have gone that would have represented mercy as well as justice, as well as safety for society? Because I don't like the death penalty. It turns we the people, including you and I, into murderers.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, do you really want to spend all your tax dollar on feeding and housing Jeffrey Dahmer or Charlie Manson or the Night Stalker or Ted Bundy? It's a complicated question.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a devil's island to send them to? I'm not sure.
I mean, I suppose this gets off topic a little, but I suppose that part of my, you know, when it comes to men like that, men who are sadistic and you could argue evil, you know, sociopathic, who are not redeemable, I suppose sometimes I feel like the death penalty lets them off too easy. And I don't want them to get away with it.
Well,
but in general, I oppose the death penalty because I think that it's just too risky and too unethical. And, well, you know, who gets to decide who lives and dies, you know?
No, you're right. There are too many innocent, usually men, who've been executed. And there are too many really innocent women who've been sentenced to life sentences for killing in self-defense when they're battered by a boyfriend or a husband. So everything needs to change, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But beginning with our consciousness, I mean, these women in the shadows who live among us as pariahs, as disposable garbage, this has to end. I can barely keep reading. I'm trying to read as much as I can to use the opportunity of writing a really genre-blended book that was my privilege and my joy to write, and I miss it because now I don't have it anymore. It's out in the world, or it will soon be out in the world. And so I'm reading the studies, and they're breaking my heart because I don't see an easy way to abolish prostitution. And it's so awful. You understand why? I mean, I understand there are women who front for male pimps. I understand that there are women who are madams and who are pimps. I get that all. But to have feminists say, listen, it's cool and groovy. You know, it's a work. It's sex work. It's like working on the killing field. It's no different than working in the plutonium factory. Get with it. And the abolitionists are seen as no fun prudes. I don't get the feminism.
I wonder if you think, would you argue that prostitutes have the right to defend themselves against rape? And what counts as rape when we're talking about prostitution?
Good questions. Yes, I do think the answer to your first question, prostitutes are definite. That's why I went into this. Prostitutes do have the right to defend their lives. And they are being paid to be raped. That's the deal. So, no, they can't kill because they're being raped. But if they're being tortured, why the hell not? And she has some descriptions that I have in the book that are, you know, horrifying. It's not just the cursing. It's not just the demeaning. It's not just the hatred. Because she would always say, I'm tough. I can take that. That doesn't bother me. Not at all. She's like, I'm like a Marine. But it's when they bite your nipples off. It's when they beat you up so that you can't be recognized as male or female. It's when they ruin and batter your innards, your insides, when they leave you for dead. Okay? Yeah, I think she has the right to defend herself from that. And that's all too common. It's not just, you know, older men who are grateful for a little sexual pleasure from somebody much younger than themselves. That's in the minority. That exists. Majority, it's not like that. Read the book if you haven't, and you'll see some of her descriptions of her life on the road. And, you know, I hope that this work is of use, because I'm thinking of the work long ago of Kathy Barry in 79, Female Sexual Slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And Raymond's The Transsexual Empire came out.
Mm-hmm.
And the work of Bob Brannon and Jan Raymond and Julie Bindel and Dorchen Lightholt and Meg Baldwin, and then the memoirs, especially one by Rachel Moran.
Mm-hmm.
The work on trauma done by Judy Herman, and I mentioned before Melissa Farley, I hope that this book is of use to them in their work. I hope that it helps. I mean, it's a very good yarn. It's a very lurid, dramatic, fast-moving tale, which was my goal for it. But then there's the issues that can be discussed around it as well.
What did Eileen think about feminism?
Oh, she loved it. But then, remember, she would have loved agreeing with or adopting the lingo of anyone who was paying for her time, on her side, paying her for sex.
Mm.
Right? She was a quick study, as I said. And she said all kinds of feminist things right back at me. You know, I enjoyed that. Did I believe she meant it? Not exactly. I don't think she had an understanding of what she stood for. She thought she was now famous in history, was known, and indeed many of the fan base who've written songs to her and incredible stuff, they think that she really gave authority thumbs up, that she really stuck it to them. A nobody who became a somebody, and famous too. This is how she was seen, an anti-authority figure, a biker, a renegade biker, you know, an outlaw. She was an outlaw figure. And that's like folklore in America. But she was also this abused child and this cognitively impaired woman, cognitively, visually, and in terms of hearing. It's interesting, towards the end of the book, I write about her last day on Earth. And she wanted to be dressed, as I can recall, with wearing white, with a cross in her hands and a cross and earrings that were crosses, Christian crosses, and around her neck a crucifix as well, and then a Bible. But that's how she wants to be received in heaven. But she went to her executioners, her enemies, her opponents, wearing biker boots and dressed in black. I mean, she was both. Mm-hmm. She was both. Her earthly torment, as I write, she asks, it's a little bit contradictory, she asks to be dressed in a black Harley Davidson t-shirt, biker style boots, and a military belt. She also wants to be seen as a shit-kicking mercenary, someone who is going out as a renegade, at war with the ruling classes, proud and defiant to her very last breath. So Lee is a religious Christian, a biker outlaw, a Marine, a much sinned against child, a happy-go-lucky hooker, a wheeler dealer, and a secretive serial killer.
How did the process of writing this book impact you?
When I'm writing it, it was huge to resurrect an archive that had been long ago, you know, shelved, and to get stuff off floppy disks so I could type it up and see what the interview said. And that was very hard. But I was also very determined and joyfully determined to lay her to rest finally with some gravity and some dignity, which I hope I did. And otherwise, I was haunted by this unfinished task. Haunted. And now, I wonder what she'd say. I said to the woman I live with, I said, you know, there's one person I'd really like to know what they think of this book. Who? Well, Lee, of course. Wonder what she'd say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't ask her.
And finally, how can people get your book, Requiem for a Female Serial Killer?
Well, it's up on Amazon. It's up on Barnes & Noble. I have links to it at my website. They can't miss it, but they can't get a copy until November 12th. Which is when they can get the Kindle, they can get the audiobook, and they can get the paperback, and they can get the hardcover. And the audiobook is read by a wonderful actress named Anne Osborne, who is going to do a reading on November 17th for a Zoom event, a book reading for this. And I think if they go to my website, phyllis-chesler.com, I have some quotes, some endorsements for this book on my homepage, and that alone should lead somebody to the to the Amazon link or the Barnes & Noble link or whatever the book, the independent bookstore links.
Great. Thank you so much. This was a fascinating conversation. It was really interesting to talk with you about Eileen and all of this. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Megan, for yours as well.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
You just heard an interview with Phyllis Chesler, author of Requiem for a Female Serial Killer. To learn more about her work, visit phyllis-chesler.com. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.